This episode of Pop the Left features the second half of a conversation with Derek Varn and Douglas Lane on the Communist Manifesto. This is pop. Yeah, yeah. This is pop, pop. There's a bunch of stuff in the Communist Manifesto that struck me as somewhat difficult for the kind of Marxism that I tend to subscribe to.
Right. And also, I mean, difficult to defend when you look at the critiques that Marx and Engels make of the Goethe and Erfurt programs, because you're like, well, didn't you guys critique that? But you're proposing it like 20 years before.
Can you give me an example from the critique of the Goethe program that...
Well, I mean, one of the biggest things is the focus on state development. Like that's a huge difference, because they are way more skeptical of that under the current state regime in the 1860s and 70s than they are in 1848. Like they seem to be a lot more hesitant. They also seem more hesitant to use taxes for things. It is less and less a part of their platform. Early on, they seem to have a lot. I mean, like, their tax proposals seem like just more radical versions of like standard progressive tax calls. Now, like, you know, don't use regressive consumption taxes when you can use income taxes, and use inheritance taxes where possible and not tariffs.
Right. So, okay, one of the things that's in the critique of the Goethe program that I think is key is their critique of redistributionist policies.
Right.
And a progressive graduated income tax
is a redistributionist policy.
That is what it is. And one of the things that's missing from the Communist Manifesto directly is the idea of the transformation of the means of production away from the production of commodities, which I think is in the critique of the Goethe program, not stated so completely directly, but it is there, and it's not here.
I'm going to refer to the Hal Draper's Karl Marx's Politics and Theory of Revolution, I think is the name of the five volumes of books that this I'm referring to. But he points out that originally Marx wanted to do this survey of the entirety of bourgeois society, including the bourgeois theory of state and the bourgeois theory of revolution and all this other stuff. And when he starts out doing the whole doing his combination of French socialism with English political economy and Hegelian, you know, that gives us capital, that ends up being a big enough thing for the rest of his life, and he doesn't even really finish that. And I think it becomes increasingly I don't want to overinterpret Marx here. We don't know that it was a profound shift in thought. But if you look at the shift of his concerns of what he was writing about, it seems like him looking at the commodity relationship became more and more central to his conception of capitalism. And while it is here in the manifesto, it is way more nebulous and not as systemically wrung out.
It's clear that his critique of the material conditions and that his class analysis is caught up in the way that things are produced.
Right. And the social relations. Obviously hold labor theory of value this early.
He does. Yeah.
Right. But
whose and how well worked out was it? You know,
it's not clear. I mean, and it seems like honestly at this point in his life, the person who'd actually done more economic work had been Engels, not Marx. Like this is like the beginning of that shift.
Yeah, the major thing that got to me was the emphasis on class, and this is because my flirtation with Moshe Pistone. As some people say that you can understand his Marxism by thinking of him as a Marxist who stopped focusing on the Communist Manifesto and started focusing on Capital Volume 1 instead. Mm-hmm. That he's someone who no longer thought of Marxism in terms of the proletariat and its class struggle, and instead started thinking of it in terms of the commodity fetish. right. overcoming that. There's, I think, almost a religious compulsion amongst Marxists to pretend as though Marx could not have evolved, or that you can never, there's nothing to ever critique. It's all one unified work, like the Bible.
And there is this compulsion, or there's an opposite compulsion that I think is also kind of interestingly pernicious, that there's a singular hard epistemic shift. Which I also like, that's all two sayers.
Right. Know, I know. I'm thinking of that. The opposite exists as well, but that's right. Like, you can actually break it in half and say, throw out all of this stuff, the younger Marx and embrace.
Right. Where it seems to me like you have a progression where things get more and more refined and some things do get abandoned. I mean, you know, a lot of the key concepts of Marxism aren't in here. Or they're not in the manifesto. We read them back into it sometimes. The dictatorship of the proletariat is not in here. You know, Marx's conception of you know what the problems of socialism are. I mean, one of the funniest things about the manifesto is like, there's five pages where he's basically shitting on the group that immediately preceded the one that they just made, and people who were in this group are implicated. Like, we forget this, but like the reactionary socialism section, B and C are literally about the revolutionary French socialist, and also the League of the Just, the Chartist, you know.
Right. Well, I think he's pretty soft on the Chartists, though, for the most part.
Yeah, well, because the Chartists actually aren't dealing with they're mostly dealing with universal suffrage.
Right. He talks about them. I was reading through all the different kinds of socialists and that he's bashing, and so like the first one was what, the true socialists?
Yeah, well, the first one is a feudal socialist, which are like the reactionary, you know, wasn't it better when we all lived on, you know, on the communal peasant manse or whatever,
the proto-anarchist primitivists.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not fair, really.
Anarcho-monarchist.
Yeah, anarcho-monarchist, right. But the ones that got to me were the true socialists, because he was saying that these are people who oppose any radical reform in the name of a better, true, worked out utopian socialism. And I wonder if there are a lot of true socialists today wandering around, you know, people who say, oh yeah, no, I can't support this or that movement because it's not what was in Zeitgeist or you know, right. Whatever. It's not the
right. I mean, yeah, I think we have a lot of that. I mean, honestly, I think you and I have been dangerously close to it too, ourselves.
Well, then the one that got me that I thought I was really close to was being a conservative socialist. And it's a similar, it sounds similar, but the more practical version of the true socialist is this conservative socialist who doesn't respect any revolutionary movement because no mere political reform will ever be enough, but only a change in the material conditions of existence. And I'm like, ooh, he's hitting me. But then he goes on, by changes in the material conditions of existence, this form of socialism, however, by no means understands abolition of the bourgeois relations of production, an abolition that can be effected only by a revolution, but administrative reforms based on the continued existence of these relations. Reforms, therefore, that in no respect affect the relations between capital and labor, but at the best lessen the cost and simplify the administrative work of bourgeois government. If I'm reading this correctly here, one of his problems is not that they're against reforms, but that they're against revolution because political change won't be enough.
Right. Well, I mean, they're against politics as such until you have total social change. And
but they actually are reformist, though.
Right. They end up being reformist because
what they want to do is create administrative reforms, maybe in a prefigurative way. to create socialism as a system that's complete within the society that they're already within, rather than contesting political power through a revolutionary movement. So he's bashing them for being reformist and against any and every revolutionary movement that the working class involves themselves in. And that's key to understand. He's not bashing them for being depreciating reformist movements or deprecating reformist movements.
I also found it clarifying to read this whole, February 1848 manuscript, including actually the draft of a Communist Confession of Faith and the Principles of Communism, which are Engels' two prior attempts at basically like it, and it shows you too how still religious a lot of this stuff was, because Engels's first thought in drafting this is not as a manifesto but as a catechism. So like that's the kind of people he thinks he's talking to. And I find that fascinating, because there are some things in those question and answer sections that are interesting, because they give you clearer definitions that, because Marx's method is actually want to give you an axiomatic definition. Like, and that shows up even in this. Whereas like Engels has got no problem saying like, hey, this means this. This is what this is.
He's sometimes wrong when he does that.
Oh yeah. And it's interesting what he talks about. So I had always talked about, for example, I had read in a couple of sources that Marx had changed the definition of proletariat and removed the footnote where he explains it. Well, it wasn't really a footnote. When I was going through all this and then looking at some of the philological manuscripts, what that actually was him revising one of the definitions in, I think, the Communist Confession of Faith. And it's so we could talk about this in specific to 1848, because this is interesting, because this also comes up in Engels' History of the Communist League. Question 7, what is a proletariat? Answer. The proletariat is a class of society which is exclusively by its labor and not on the profit from any kind of capital. That class whose weal and woe, whose life and death, therefore, is dependent on the optimization of times of good and bad business, in a word, on the fluctuations of competition. Now, this is interesting to me, because the definition of proletariat is different than what most of us use under Marxism now, because it's more direct than either producing commodities, actually, or being dependent on the general wage fund, which is the way most modern Marxists used it. Engels says it's like you live exclusively by your labor, which actually would also make some petty bourgeois proletariat, which is interesting too, because Engels uses proletariat to refer to the artisans in that history, which I don't think Marx would do. But this is the other thing with the distinction being made. Have there not always been proletarians? Answer, according to Engels, no. There have always been poor and working classes. Those who have worked were almost always the poor. But there have not always been proletariat, just as competition has not always been free. And this is Engels' answer to how the proletariat arise. And I really want to focus in on this, because this is interesting in 1848, but maybe complicated by what you and I know about capital. And this is long, and so people have to forgive me. The proletariat came into being as a result of the introduction of machines, which have been invented since the Middle Ages of the last century, and the most important of which are the steam engine, the spinning machine, and the power loom. These machines, which were very expensive and therefore could be only purchased by rich people, supplanted the workers of the time. Because of the use of machinery, it made possible to produce commodities more quickly and cheaply than could the workers with their imperfect spinning wheels and hand looms. The machines thus delivered the industry entirely into the hands of big capitalists and rendered the workers scanty property, which consisted mainly of their tools, looms, etc., quite worthless, so that the capitalists were left with everything and the worker with nothing. In this way, the factory system was introduced. Once capitalism saw the advantageous this was for them, they sought to extend it more and more branches of labor. They divided work more and more between the workers, so that the workers who formerly had made the whole article now produce only part of it. Labor simplified in this way could produce goods more quickly and therefore more cheaply, and it was only now found in almost every branch of labor that here also machines could be used. As soon as any branch of labor went over to the factory production, it ended up, just as in the case of the spinning and weaving, in the hands of big capitalists, and the workers were deprived of the last remnants of their independence. We gradually arrived at the position where there are almost all branches of labor are run by factory basis. This increasingly brought about the ruin of previously existing middle class, especially the small master craftsmen, completely transformed from their previous position of the workers, and two new classes which were gradually swallowed up all other classes became named. One, the class of big capitalists, who in the advanced countries are almost exclusively in possession of the means of subsistence, and those means, machines, factories, workshops, which by subsistence are produced, thus the bourgeois class or the bourgeoisie, and the completely propertyless, who are compelled to sell their labor to the first class, the bourgeoisie, simply to obtain from them and return the means of their subsistence. Since these parties are trading labor are not equal, but the bourgeois have the advantage, the propertyless must submit bad conditions laid down by the bourgeoisie. The class are dependent on the bourgeoisie is called the proletarian or the proletariat.
I have an inkling of what your objections would be, and I think they're probably going to be the same as mine. I have my own objections here to some of this. It's not like I completely disagree, but where would you start to pick at that description?
Well, one, I think it puts into the hands of the relations of production wage labor into the relation of machines, the machines that made wage labor more efficient. But wage labor in England predates those machines, which I think Marx knew. And I think Engels knew later. I mean, this is also early on. I do not disagree with Engels that like the machines would make this a lot more obvious, because they speed up the process, but this had started in England 100 years prior. And before those machines had really caught on, although they did caught on first in textiles. Two, I noticed that Engels sees this as almost solely bad. But when Marx revises that into the sections that become bourgeois and proletarian and communist, which are, you know, by far the bulk of the manifesto's like theoretical apparatus, he actually makes the bourgeois way more heroic and way less dependent on those machines. Marx sees it as a social relation, not just a machine problem. That even shows up in the manifesto, but it isn't totally excised. And I think by the time you get the capital and you look at the commodity and not just the machine relations of the commodity, that's when that really changes.
I mean, in capital,
machines play a role.
The machines play a big role, but it's as capital, right? And the value of those machines are still produced, still a product of labor in themselves. And so by the time these machines arrive for use by a mass proletariat, there already has to have been a commodity, this relationship between a bourgeois and proletariat, or a worker and boss. Or I mean, you already have to have a pretty massive amount of exploitation.
Right. And you will notice there's no talk of the commodity form in that at all. There is talk of capital, which is interesting, right? And the commodity form, if we talk about commodity relations, Marx places that all the way back into antique society, because he talks about slaves messing up that being manifest, but already kind of being there when Aristotle is writing.
Right. But this is something I've gone over and over as I reread Capital recently with people. Yes, he does. But I think from my understanding of this is that what matters most in terms of capitalism, the kind of capital that dominates society now, the society that might also be industrialized, you know, or dominated by industrial modes of production, is the law-like property of the exchanges based on these abstract labor values that don't really arise in antiquity.
No, because there's very little wage relation.
And there's not as much exchange. There's just not – things aren't produced primarily for exchange. I mean, there is exchange. So there's certainly trade, and things are – there's also theft, you know, and exploitation. There's a lot of that, but there's not as much. Things aren't built on a market quite the same way.
So when you see Engels' definition there, and I think parts of it are insightful, I don't want to completely discount it, but like that lack of a function of a commodity and that lack of a function of the way wage labor intercedes.
Yeah, there's this almost this idea like there were two sets of capitalists or two sets of bourgeoisie, and some of them had machines, and the richer of those had machines, and they dominated the poorer artisan workers, but they were basically, there's still maybe a hangover of this idea of there being a bourgeois industrial class, you know, that then was upended by the introduction of these machines, and then which then necessitated concentration of capital in a few hands, which when in fact I think the system itself of capital production, regardless of the, I mean, the machines play a role in it.
But the role of competition on a market with wage labor leads to the concentration of capital.
Right. But it also, it does it through the investment in new modes of production.
Right. And, which could be simply just different wage labors, right? But in a lot of cases were machines.
There were machines. There could be intensification of you know, the more disciplining of labor. Could be a new form of cooperation on an assembly line, or just rearranging the production so it's more efficient. You know, it could be a variety of things that ends up meaning that you can speed up the production and then concentrate the capital into fewer and fewer hands.
I also think if we look at Engels there, we have to look at Engels' background in a factory, whereas Marx is actually trying to look at things in a broader sense. I mean, Engels is a socialist who comes out of managing a factory.
Right. Oh, I mean, for sure. And the thing is, it's not – I mean, this is –
this isn't totally wrong.
This isn't wrong, yeah. It's exactly –
it's just missing some key components that we consider – crucial to Marxism.
Also you can find in the Communist Manifesto the emphasis on the elimination of private property which is, you definitely have to do, right? I mean, but it replaces the or if not thoroughly thought through, it can lead to, and especially if the manifesto is really all you're basing your politics on in the 20th or 21st century, could definitely lead to a statist and, you know, totalitarian kind of politics where you just assume, well, if the state holds all the property and regulates all the wage relations and, you know, controls all the land, that's socialism. That, you know, that's equality. And not understanding that the property relations are not meant to be, you know, disappearing into the ownership of one institution, but rather the whole notion of property should become irrelevant in such an abundant society where the fetters have been taken off productive activity is the idea in the Communist Manifesto.
Right. So, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, you, it's just interesting if you just look at the writing of the manifesto and the dialogue between Marx and Engels that Marx is already working a lot of this out. And it definitely makes a lot of the stuff make sense in the context of London and of the political developments in the 1830s and 1840s. But that Marx and Engels together really start seeing things that give you things that are way more predictive than these early texts indicate. And you only, to me, get the beginnings of it in the manifesto. And if you read the wrong parts of the manifesto, or if you read it uncritically, or if you read it as purely analytical and as a program now that we can just embark upon, which, I mean, admittedly, very few people actually take its political demands as contemporary demands, except for like reactionaries who want to talk about how we're all secretly communist already. It seems to me that like looking at this in the context of 1848 is particularly interesting because Marx and Engels are beginning to see past something, but they're just beginning to. And it does make a lot of the controversies, I think, of communist politics, you know, in the late 19th and 20th and now in the 21st century make a little bit of sense. because, like, depending on what you're hooking onto and how much you're insisting that all this is singularly coherent and doesn't change at all can really change your reading about what's going on. Because superficially, some of these things look like they're the same thing, but there's, like, the lack of the certain components is really actually important for figuring out stuff later.
In general, the thing about reading the history of the socialist movement and reading Marx and Engels thoroughly and you know, trying to actually read critically is that the problems don't – they get more nuanced and they get deeper, but they don't go away.
Right. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, even as early, even in this early stuff is like figuring out the precise communist relationship to nationalism and internationalism is actually a little difficult. So
put it in a different framing, just when you think of the problem being changing the mode of production to get away from commodity production and to something like communist production, you're only beginning to describe things in an abstract theoretical way. You're actually not at a politics yet. I think that's one of the reasons why there's such a drive to sort of simplify and think of things in terms of gaining state power and not worrying about that more radical transformation of society. And especially when you start to look at the, you know, Christian utopian roots of all this. It can be tempting, I think, to say, you know, none of this has ever – the real communism, the real vision has always been utopian. The practical demands are what we should hold on to, which case you end up, you know, really having, I guess, a fluctuating social democratic politics that you call socialist.
Right. Although, I mean – I'll also get to one of the things that you see in 1848 that also haunts us that we haven't talked about. And that is in section 4 of the actual manifesto. And that is the position of the communists in relation to various existing opposition parties.
Oh, yeah. Let me open that up. I'm right here.
Because I actually think this is a bag of worms.
In France, the communists ally with the social democrats against the conservative and radical bourgeoisie, reserving, however, the right to take up a critical position in regard to phases and illusions traditionally handed down from the Great Revolution.
So we're going to try to wrestle certain positions from the radical bourgeoisie even while opposing them. But – okay, so this actually leads to things like the idea of the popular and united fronts, right? The united front being the older idea, the popular front being the later idea, but that having to do with what counts as the illusions and phases of the radical bourgeoisie.
Well, no, wait. They ally with the social democrats.
Against the radical bourgeoisie, reserving the right, however, to take up a critical position
in regard to phases and illusions that the social democrats have taken from the Great Revolution.
That's not what it says. The modifier is the radical bourgeoisie. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to reserve that right because they're already aligned with the social democrats.
No, but a critical position, you don't need to take a critical position against people you're already against. You don't need to reserve a right to do that. That's what you're doing. You're already in a critical position against the radical bourgeoisie.
But the relationship of the social democrats to the radical bourgeoisie is more complicated. And then we get to the other countries.
Right. Okay. That's true. But I'm just saying here, the social democrats, I mean, the distinction between social democrats and radical bourgeoisie is not one that I can suss out. Okay. You can refer to earlier parts of the text where they talk about the radical bourgeoisie and the kinds of things that they would say in order to undermine Republican movements.
Right.
Okay, so you can go back.
Look at what it says in Switzerland, though. They support the radicals without losing sight of the fact that this partly consists of antagonistic elements, partly of the democratic socialist in the French sense, partly of the radical bourgeoisie. So in Switzerland, we take a different alignment towards the radical bourgeoisie because of the semi-feudal nature of the state. All right. But then we get to Poland. In Poland, they support the party that insists on an agrarian revolution as a prime condition for national emancipation. So we're not even at that point there. We're just like we have a peasant revolution as a precondition for national emancipation. All right. Now, this position actually is debated later on between the Bolsheviks and Rosa Luxemburg, who takes a much more critical position about Polish national emancipation. But anyway, in Germany, they fight with the bourgeoisie whenever it acts in a revolutionary way against the absolute monarchy, the feudal squirearchy, and the petty bourgeoisie.
Right. They are realists. They try to side with the whatever the best of the worst would be in a given. They don't come in hoping to change the conditions through their own political force.
Doesn't this make the whole fight with the LaSallians over the relationship to the Bismarckian state interesting? Because by LaSallian logic, they are still holding to the manifesto. Well, Marx and Engels are actually the people who are moving beyond it. I think you kind of have to look at that one of the reasons I think Marxist politics are kind of all over the place is there was this opportunism and this kind of like brutal realism in Marx, but it actually doesn't lead to a clear picture of what you're supposed to do, because there are people who pick up banners of stuff said in this manifesto that we kind of drop. They don't do it in the way Marx and Engels would like, or maybe Marx and Engels might even think at this point that part of the manifesto was no longer totally relevant, although the prefaces written by Engels would indicate otherwise, but still. Which means that so in Germany, they fight with the bourgeoisie whenever it acts in a revolutionary way against the absolute monarchy. Okay, so they would oppose the Bismarckian state, kind of. Against the feudal squirearchy, which doesn't exist by the time you get to that point, and against the petty bourgeoisie. But they never cease for a single instant to instill the working class with the clearest possible recognition of hostile antagonism between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, in order that the German workers may straightway use as many weapons against bourgeoisie, the social and political conditions the bourgeoisie must necessarily introduce along with its supremacy, in order that after the fall of the reactionary classes in Germany, the fight itself against the bourgeoisie may immediately begin. And this is what I wanted to pick up, is the tension about when you would have won against the reactionary classes in Germany is probably what's at stake in Marx's mind. And it also – this makes sense as to why they would have been part of those greater coalitions in 1848 with people who they would diametrically and dieheartedly oppose 10, 15, 20 years later, and not even over a massive change of position.
First we fight Trump, then we fight the Democratic Party.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but that's the logic. The communists turned their attention chiefly to Germany. Now, I actually point this out because this has been a problem forever. One of the things that I was pointing out in the Mike McNair podcast is why were the communists in the various Eastern European and Eastern revolutions so myopically focused on Germany? Part of it has to do with development and Germany's industrial development, because it didn't have as many colonial holdings. It had to be more efficient. But part of it has to do with the fact that it just says so in the manifesto. All right. I mean, I'm serious. The communists turned their attention chiefly to Germany because that country is on the eve of a bourgeois revolution that is bound to be carried out under the more advanced conditions of European civilization and with much more developed proletariat than that of England was in the 17th and France in the 18th century. And because the bourgeois revolution in Germany will all but prelude and immediately following the proletarian revolution. But by this logic, you should actually focus on the United States now.
This part of the Communist Manifesto was proven wrong by 1849. Okay? I mean, they were right in a sense that they really were on the eve of the bourgeois revolution. Right? They were seeing that correctly, but they were overly optimistic about the outcome. They thought the bourgeoisie were going to win. They lost.
Right. I mean, they won concessions that eventually enabled them to take over later.
Eventually, they won concessions, but they didn't even win that revolution. They were put down.
In all these moments, they bring the front foot is leading the crappy, the property crushing, no matter what degree of time. And that actually comes up, right? Because and Ingalls talks about how the Communist Party is kind of born. And one of the funny things about that Communist Party stuff, and we were reading it earlier as if it came before the manifesto. It seems to be in development before the manifesto, but it's actually part of the political program later.
Is that right? Because I remember.
Let's look at that again. I'm pretty sure it is because
I'm reading. Okay, so we've got the on the history of the Communist League.
Right, and so in Paris. Oh no, in Paris we soon came together, and the following the new Central Committee, it distributed throughout Germany one of the current events. It was after the February Revolution broke out and the London Central Committee functioning hitherto in March 1848. No, this is right before. So this is like – but when I say right before – no, this is in March. And the manifesto is done in February. So these demands are actually a few months later.
They abolished the League of the Just, and they came up with the aim of the League is to overthrow the bourgeoisie – the rule of the proletariat, the abolition of the old bourgeois society based on class antagonisms. This is their new motto that came out.
Yeah, that came out, and then they write the manifesto. Yeah.
And then Second Congress took place at the end of November and beginning of December the same year. Marx attended. The February Revolution broke out. And then in Paris, we all soon came together again and drafted this. But they were sent away to do the communist, write the Communist Manifesto.
By themselves. So the Communist Manifesto demands are just Marx and Engels, where – as the Communist Party demands, which come literally just 2 months later, are the five committee, the three main people from the Communist Correspondence Committee, and two of the Bauer snapper faction of the old League of the Just wrote that together. And also those demands also seem more immediately about 1848 than the manifesto demands does. So it's interesting because the manifesto demands seem like they're more advanced, right? But I think it's just because Marx and Engels were writing them alone. but I point all that out because that's how crazy this all was. But we keep on forgetting, like, all this is in a very highly shifting social context. But one of the signs that they lose, all right, In 1852, the Communist League gets dissolved. Why? Well, because a spy from one of the German principalities, and again, we're still in German principalities. It's the squirearchy as set up by Metternich. Still, they send in a spy who steals the register from one of the people in Switzerland, and they are able to arrest the communist members in Germany. So in response to this, because communists dare not hide their name and now they have to, they dissolve the League. And that leads to the creation of the First International a little while later.
And that's all – yeah, right. And that's all after – when did that spy
– about 1851, and the trial in Cologne is in 1852.
Yeah. So this is all like after the failure of
it's during the counter-revolution basically. I mean, like Marx is in London writing, you know, at this point – Engels is back in London after having to flee, after going back into Germany. So this is after the great mess has commenced. Yeah, I feel like everybody just ignores everything prior to, say, the Second International. Like, that's where everybody wants to pick up. Like, because, like, we get to, like, like when you normally, I mean, me too. Like one of the most fascinating time periods is Engels and Kautsky to Engels Lenin, right? And then everybody, Engels and Kautsky to Kautsky Lenin, and then everybody wants to talk about 1910 to 1918. but this stuff is really super important, and the fact that all this is live and on the ground is shifting and changing, and that Marx. That Marx does exist in historical context himself, even though he does seem to be one of the best people about seeing stuff that's going to emerge beyond it. It's still in a particular moment, and stuff – we have to be careful reading stuff back into things because we know what's going to come. Because, I mean, I really do think some of the key concepts of Marxism actually aren't in the manifesto. Like anywhere.
Or that Marx's key concepts. Because the other thing I want to break from is this idea that there is a Marxism that makes any sense. You know, there isn't a Marxism. I mean, there's a Marxism in the same way there's a Platonism, maybe.
There's a bunch of traditions, kind of, sort of.
Yeah. That, you know, there's Neoplatonism and they all hate each other, all the different kinds of Neoplatonists, right? I mean, that's what you have when you're talking about Marxism as an intellectual tradition and as a political struggle. I mean, you talked about Eugene Debs not really having read Marx until he was well up within the
yeah, conflict. I mean, and also, like, one of the things that's interesting about Debs is some things that Marx hits on or that Engels hits on, or that there were tensions that were emerging in the League of the Just and the Communist League, or tensions that are emerging 20, 30, 40 years later in the guild unions versus the industrial unions in the United States. But the Debs context initially is just in unionizing and in dealing with the politics around union gains. It only later becomes about building socialism, like once the SPA really gets going. And that's when he becomes more fruitfully a Marxist. But some of the – it seems like he was seeing some of the things that Marx was seeing, and that's what glommed him to Marx. So like that's interesting to me, but I don't know what that really tells you.
Well, do you think it would be fair to say that the struggle to create a democratic republic, and which really was a way of trying to realize the ideals that seemed to become possible due to technological advances and due to scientific advances and the way that old institutions of authority were disintegrating in the face of, say, scientific revolutions, that this drive to liberate humanity and to be self-responsible leads, you know, always will come along with a desire to overcome, let's say, capitalism or the contradictions that are within this current system. And then that there are different, then that will lead you to theorize, but that the movements will start up from the contradictions of ideological and other and material in this
right,
culture.
Right. So, for example, in socialism in the United States, until Marxism came into it, followed a slightly different path. It was inspired by Saint-Simon and Fourier, but it led to stuff like the Georgist. And people who were concerned with the limitations of land, which is – and that's also kind of an issue in the tensions between and between the Zapatistas, the first round of Zapatistas, you know, the original, the OGs, not the 90s to current ones, the Zapata fans in the Mexican Revolution. And the like the Norteño faction, which was more industrial in Mexico, because those tensions flared up there. But, you know, while there were Marxists in that revolution, it had a different context, partly because the relationship to industrialism and land was actually kind of very different than in Europe, where there just was less land and it was already owned. And when it was redistributed, it was still – there just wasn't that much of it to redistribute. And you didn't have the ability to expand the holdings through – except through colonialism. And in the United States, we had direct imperialism to expand into, old style. Like, we're just going to take your land, native peoples. So that changes the relationship. And I think it's why the American history of socialism is a little different. And Engels writes about this actually a lot. Marx doesn't so much, but Engels was in enough correspondence with stuff going on in America and had actually visited, I believe, to have a better idea of the problems there. And he was afraid that there weren't going to be a clear working class in the United States because of the relationship to land. And how that had changed the political development. That's why there was no like working class party there. And to be fair, he was probably somewhat right. We don't have a working class party. Like our two parties, we have a bourgeois party and a populist party, really. Historically speaking, that's their origins. So the bourgeois party is Republicans. And when the bourgeois was progressive, they were. So that ends around 1920 at best. And the Populist Party is the Democrats, which is why the Democrats have never had a consistent ideology or even a clear uniform base. Their base is always shifting, like constantly. And so that's interesting too. I mean, like, and that seems to come out of like the way that material played differently here. But Marx's answer to this, Marx's way of approaching these problems, I think would lead you to see how this would happen. Even if Marx didn't directly write about it, because Marx, frankly, like, you know, when he talks about things other than Europe, it's in letters that he tosses off. Like, he's unsure about what – I mean, like, first he endorses British imperialism in India. Then he, like, retracts it. Then he's like, no, you don't need to develop capitalism in the same way in Russia because there's a completely different relationship of political economy there because of the way the peasant co-ops work. Maybe something else will happen. It's not yet to be seen. But these he doesn't actually even formally theorize about. They're in letters that he revised and kind of rethought, but they're not in public writings. You know, even his thoughts on America are really only in letters to Lincoln. Like, it's more Ingalls who actually like writes more of that stuff out in the open.
Well, I think there's two things that we might want from Marx, and I'm not sure we're going to really get the second thing. The first thing we want from Marx, and I think he delivered it, is a good theoretical working out of the abstract terms of the social relationships that define capitalism, right? Right. And I think he delivered that. But the other thing you might want from Marx, and that in a way his earlier work is more directly involved in, is to see how the capitalist project and the political ideological projects that brought it into being are going to work out towards socialism, right? That you want kind of a roadmap of how to get from capitalism to socialism, or even more, how to get from whatever the old form would be, whether it's monarchical or imperial or feudal, or you know, or some crazy Asian thing, as you might put it, right? You know, how to get from that to socialism. And I don't think you're going to find that fully worked out. And that's what you're saying, and I agree with you. I don't think you're going to be able to find that in Marx. And I think that's really should be not just something we do theoretically or that we look to historically, because clearly it hasn't happened. So that's something we have to create. That's something we have to do.
I mean, and we haven't got there yet. I mean, like, and it's one of the most frustrating things to say when you're 250 fucking years out.
Right.
You know,
that's not that long, though. I mean,
okay, if we count, let's count from the French Revolution and the emergence of the first socialist. So let's see. We're not going to start with the diggers. That's too early. That's like, that actually puts us like at 400 years.
We could start there, but I mean, that's a long time. But let's say we start at 17. Let's start at 1776.
Let's start at 1776. Then, yeah, we are approaching 250 years out.
I know. I'm just saying it's not that. I mean, that's a long time in human life, you know, from the perspective of an individual. It may not be that long if you consider how long it took to for the bourgeois revolutions to really happen.
Well, I mean, you and I have talked about this. It's somewhere between like the emergence of the beginnings of the conditions that would lead to capitalism emerges between the 9th and 14th century. And the fact that I can't even tell you exactly when that begins tells you the problem of it, right? Like,
right. I would say the 14th century is where we maybe would want to.
Yeah, I think so too. Capitalism. I think you see experiments where all three components are there, but they're not there in a way that could ever go anywhere.
All right. So that's 500 right. years.
Right. So, you know, but Marx seemed to have thought that stuff was pretty close to on hand.
the bourgeois revolution, when it really fully arrived, it came along with socialism right away.
It's there for moment one. Like that's always when I would like argue with libertarians back when I did such a thing 10, 15 years ago. And they would talk about classical liberalism. And I was like, look, we're all descendants of classical liberalism. Even like Stalinists are descendants of classical liberalism, as much as they will get all pissy about me saying that. But we are. Like, the only people who aren't are like monarchist and I guess out and out uber reactionaries of the Demestra variety. So
what's the difference? What do they believe? The Demestra people?
They believe in blood and soil plus God and King, you know, as opposed to just God and King, I guess.
So that's pretty much just another form of monarchism.
Yeah, it is. Right? I mean, it's monarchism, but monarchism.
With a modernist update.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. It's like, we're monarchists, but we believe in these things that came out of, you know, basically liberal modernity.
Right. And we're pissed off about it. So, but I mean, like everybody else is in some descent, you know, descended from classical liberalism. Marxism, you know, is I think that, you know, there's a book, you know, Marxism and Post-Marxism, but, you know, it refers to Marxism as the loyal opposition to modernity. I think that's pretty much true. I think that's what we are. We're like the rebellious stepchildren of classical liberalism who think that the parents drunk and probably should stop.
When you read the Communist Manifesto today and you try to understand our political moment to now, there does still seem to be like a disconnect. And I think it has to do with the fact that that something solidified. Everyone says, like all the Marxists after World War II said that capitalism had solidified. They were wrong.
Well, I mean, that's just it. Like, we have had phases of capitalism. I mean, you know, I remember back when we did Pop the Left the first time, and I always joked about, you know, misunderstanding the highest phase of capitalism. You know, that word in Russian actually means something more like the most recent. That was always our optimism, that we always think we're like a step ahead of it, and it's always morphing, which is funny. Because our own doctrines, you know, going back to ironically to the manifesto, should tell us it morphs. That's how it works. Like, it is an incredibly adaptive, competitive collapse machine. And the collapse, instead of killing it, always brings it back. And Marxists theoretically know that, but we forget it all the time.
If you read like C.L.R. James or what's the guy's name? Castriotis, Cornelius Castriotis, who, by the way, they worked together on a book called Facing Reality. And then they were in a group together called Facing Reality too. It's one of the, after the Johnson Forest Tendency split, they became Facing Reality. And then the book was written, and then Cornelius abandoned Marxism altogether. But if you read these guys right around 1958 or so, They're all talking as though they're all talking like Keynesians. The nation state can just overcome all the contradictions within capitalism forever and know there'll never be freedom again.
Right. They pretty much. I mean, they have a tendency to just give up. So
they don't see it, and we look at it back at that time now as like some utopia that we want to go back to. Right. But they see, you know, the implementation of the welfare state as the closing off of a socialist project for freedom. And one that would not be undone. I mean, it was undone within 20 years. They just see it as permanent. And then the other weird thing about it is they see economic crisis and the working out of distribution through a capitalist model as basically in a way it's as if. They've achieved without giving us freedom. They achieved all the things we thought we wanted with freedom. That was what freedom was going to get us, was freedom from want and a rational distribution and, you know, that kind of thing in a harmonious society. And they've done it, but this is it. And look at it. is sort of what they were saying then. But what they were really missing, I think, were the kings. What they were really missing was the political enemy that had motivated the 19th century socialists to seem like their radicalism was keeping pace with the radicalism of the mode of production.
We forget about how emergent that all was, and we tend to see our own moment as way more eternal than it is, which makes it so much more interesting to me and says something about the kind of thinker Marx was, whatever critiques even I might have of him, that he actually saw certain threads that saw you beyond the moment he was in. You can't even say that for Hegel, right? Like, but you, yeah, you can in consciousness, but not in politics. Like, I mean, Hegel was one of those Gerontians, basically. I mean, he was a liberal monarchist who got more and more conservative as he got older. I mean, that, you know, like, so...
Zizek would – there's a Zizek in my, you know, subconscious is railing against this, but I'm sure
you're right. I mean, I don't think that Hegel – I mean, I used to think Hegel was reactionary, but, like, I don't think that's entirely easily to say. But to say that, like, he was ahead of the game in 1800, but behind the game by 1840 seems pretty obvious. I mean, he was dead by 1840, but, I mean, still – like
seeing past the present moment is an important thing to do. Do you think that the left is getting better?
No, I think we're getting worse at it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, look at how we're dominating. Like
maybe you and I are getting a little bit better at it.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I don't know that what – I mean, I've seen things change enough just from Obama to Trump and going from – really, anybody who's my age on the left should not think things are standing still or should not think the moment we're in is going to last forever or anything like that. Because we saw, you know, the Bush administration, just in America, Bush administration to Obama to Trump, and they're all three different kinds of total crises, you know, but defined in completely different terms. So we should know that we're not – that things are going to keep changing. I the very least, we should know that. Pop,